From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Multilateral Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark DeCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are save data, it's important, and interdisciplinary communication, also important. So if everyone's ready, let's start.
Two important topics.
Very important.
Very, very important.
Well, before we get to them, we have a couple of things on our meta list that we got to get through.
We do. Yes. Okay. So first things first.
Really important. You didn't want to waste any time before getting this out to our listeners.
Right. This is important. My brother is streaming.
Right now?
Not right now. Oh. Well, maybe. I don't know. It depends on when you're listening to this episode, listener.
Fair point. Fair point.
But he streams consistently on Fridays at 6 p.m. Central Time. And he's just streaming himself making content for his games. So like HyperDot or... OmniGear is the other game that he's working on.
Yeah. HyperDot's been out a while, but he's still working on some stuff for it.
Yes.
OmniGear is his new project.
Yes.
And so it's still early days on that one.
Yes.
That's a cool name for a game.
OmniGear?
It's a fun game, too.
OmniGear?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or HyperDot, which one?
Both.
I came up with OmniGear.
Well, it's cool.
I did.
I didn't know that.
Well, actually, no. My brother had like a list of like two different, like, what's it?
Oh, you did that thing that idea people do, is you pointed to a whiteboard and you took credit?
No, not exactly. I put two things together and then took credit.
Oh, okay, okay.
But my brother came up with a list of the things.
Yeah.
So, oh, like of like prefixes and suffixes.
Yeah, that's it. Yes, mm-hmm. That's what he did. And I was like, oh, I'm Niger. Ship it.
It's a cool name.
Yeah, thanks. Anyways, my brother, he streams. And he's been consistent. He's been doing that for a few weeks now. Did not specifically ask me to promote his stream, but because he's...
Which is why you haven't done it for the past couple weeks.
I did forget. I had intended to, very much so, but I just forgot.
Charles, if you're listening, make sure to yell at your brother about this.
Or
now,
whatever.
Now, if he does yell at you, you know he listens to the show.
He won't yell at me. So be better than my brother, I guess, and support his things, even though he doesn't support my things.
Ooh.
That felt really mean.
I mean, honestly, if you just want some more insight into why Steven is the way he is.
That's another reason to watch the stream. Yeah.
If you solve the mystery, let us know.
Oh, Dip, big news. Ellen, what's this about 120 dragons?
I'm Dragon Master.
Wow.
I finally did it.
So they're going to add new ones soon, though, right?
Yeah,
I won't know. I'm going to install it.
But they did. They added some already. I just looked it up. Just kidding. I'm Oh, you should see Ellen's face.
Wow.
She's so scared. Okay.
I had an emotional reaction to this from Steven.
I'm so sorry.
So this is Flappy Dragon for listeners who haven't been following the saga for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah.
3 or 4 week saga of Flappy Dragon, during which I got two additional friends hooked on Flappy Dragon.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we would like text each other throughout the workday like, I just got the 118th one. Ah. I'm going to do a little journal entry on it in my little game dev journal. Mm-hmm. I kind of got a little stack of, so.
I just finished Mario and Rabbids, mm-hmm. all the side missions and all the stuff. And like at each world, there's 5 worlds in the game and it keeps track of all the stuff you picked up, but doesn't tell you exactly what's left to pick up.
Oh.
It's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
But there's something to it. I sort of like not being handholded, the Ubisoft style.
Sure.
But all the worlds are like 99% complete. And I'm like, nah, I'm not hunting for 1%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got too much self-respect to do that. Which makes me think of the games that do give it to you as a checklist,
mm-hmm.
that you do go for that last 1%. And I'm like, oh man, I actually kind of respect a game for letting me step off of it, like not worrying about that last percent.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like, yeah, I did it. I pretty much did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close
yeah.
enough.
But
yeah. Like the dragons thing where it was making sure that you had all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can't just have it. I just can't stop at 119.
All right.
You know? I know how many I have left I have to get. But they also had the dragons like organized into different categories.
Mm-hmm.
So like here's your Eastern Dragon category. And here's your Cosmic Dragon category.
Mm-hmm.
They were cool. And your Western Dragon category. And so they'd have
they all little cowboy hats.
Yeehaw. It would have for every single dragon in that category a little silhouette, and when you got that dragon, it would fill in the silhouette with the dragon's name and the dragon's stats and a little bit of lore about the dragon. Mm-hmm. So not only did you know how many dragons you had left out of 120, you also knew which type of dragons you needed to hatch, mm-hmm. and what level of rarity. So it gave you a lot of specificity about what you needed to target to complete your set.
Okay.
And I think that having that level of specificity makes it the next, you know, getting just one more, getting just two more, feel a lot more achievable, which is, you know,
yeah,
more motivational to try to complete it.
Okay.
Right, because games like that will often, even if they don't have loot boxes, will still obfuscate progress so that you just keep going even if you didn't get the last thing. So this seems like a little bit better than that. Like it respects your time a little better, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's good. And it was one of the reasons why I played the heck out of it.
Yeah.
Is I really felt like I was respecting my time. Although at the beginning I was like really skeptical, but as the game evolved and the gameplay kind of like changed as you got more into it.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool.
Well, I like that we have these mini arcs of like what's Ellen playing.
It's a
good new feature for the program.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
What's Mark listening to is what I want.
Oh man! So many weeks ago, I was talking about. I guess it was almost a year ago. I was raving about that David Bowie box set.
Right.
I got,
yeah.
And that opened the door for me to talk about music on the show.
Okay.
I decided.
I'm cool with this.
This new record came out from a band called The Beths, "Expert in a Dying Field," which is such a great title, and the lyrics to the title track are like they really got me.
Yeah.
But. It's a band from New Zealand, and it's just, if anyone in the audience is my age and remembers Pete and Pete, imagine a band that would be on the soundtrack to Pete and Pete. That's it's just a rock band. Like,
okay.
I've been listening to a lot of more, like, I wouldn't, sort of like synth punk or like sort of, post-punk, new wavy kind of modern, like rock, but with a lot of like production.
Yeah.
Innovation. Like, yeah, that's sure. That's what I've been doing the last maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the music is. And just this song, it's just a rock song. And it like really brought me back to that 90s era of those kinds of bands that I loved. For some reason, I'm just totally hooked on this one record, and like to the point where I'm bringing it up on the show. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the music video for the title track. And
I mean, I'm sold on both the band name and the title of the album, because "expert in a dying field" is a phrase.
The metaphor in the song is so strong, and like that's the thing that I love about like a rock band, that if a rock band can have like three chords and good poetry. Like that goes a long way,
yeah.
You know, and they have a lot of the ingredients are right there, all the things I like. So I don't know if it'll hit other people the way it hit me, but man, it really got me. It's very dissimilar to the kind of music I've been listening to lately. So,
and maybe sad news.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it sound way worse than the problem.
Yeah, that definitely.
It's not sad news. This is going to be our last roundtable before our hiatus that we do every year.
Yeah,
what I'm trying to say. Nothing. Extremely bad has happened, as far as I know.
I had the same face, like facial expression, as I had from earlier.
With the dragon.
This team is really throwing me for a loop today.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Listeners may or may not know, you listener that I'm talking to now may or may not know.
Yes.
That every year we go on hiatus for a couple weeks, and we do nice replays during that time. So we rerun some shows that we pick from the year, our favorites, and then we do a little commentary at the top, so it's still a little bit of new content.
Yes.
But it gives us a break over the holidays, we find listeners do like it, which makes us feel a lot better, because it's a lot easier for us to put on reruns.
Yes.
But that's coming up in 2 weeks, and this is our last roundtable before then, so it's our last time to really just sort of talk about it.
That's why I'm bringing it up now.
We haven't picked the episodes yet.
No, we have not.
We're going to do that after the record today.
Yeah.
But we had some bangers this year.
We did indeed.
So look forward to a concentrated, high-quality holiday season of Nice Games Club coming up.
Yeah. It'll be good.
Steven?
Yes?
Can you maybe, just to keep this trend rolling, can you kick off Mark's topic in a way that scares the crap out of me?
You flashed your save data. All of your dragons are gone.
Oh! I didn't think you could do it so easily.
Sorry!
Dang, that worked.
There's just a darkness within me, I think.
So this is my topic, save data.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about it from a couple of angles.
Okay.
I guess, sort of... you know, from 1,000 feet, but also right down on the ground.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things that when you're making a game, it's like, yeah, I know I got to do this. I'll take care of it later.
Right. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's a pretty common kind of thing. But as you start, the thing is, it's really interesting about when you're making a game, when you decide you need save data, is sometimes it happens really early in a project. Sometimes it happens really late in a project. And I think what happens when it happens is it's when you testing it, when you just hitting play in the editor or doing a build and trying it out,
yeah,
you can no longer test what you need to test.
Yeah.
When you actually do need to have some progress and a progression in a game, and you can't just set some values or load up a different scene.
Yep.
But that can get you a long, long way.
It really can.
Like, I think we did save data really pretty relatively early in
Widget Satchel?
In Widget Satchel.
Yeah,
pretty
I
early
think
on.
We did. I think it was partly because, like, I was working on it at work, and you asked me about it, and then we were like, let's just do it now.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Oh, yeah, because I was learning a lot of Unity concepts at the time. So, yeah, we worked through it pretty early, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that might have been driven by, like, my need to learn it. Hmm. Or it might have been driven by the normal things that drive it. But I remember us doing it pretty early.
Yeah.
Whereas with Dream Settler now, we haven't built the save data system yet. Because we just don't need to.
Right.
Like, because the game is so atomized that we can really test a lot of different systems without that yet.
Yeah.
But in preparation for when that we're going to need it,
mm-hmm.
I've been building a save data library that I have also been using for the Switch ports that I'm working on this fall. And so I've been trying to sort of keep that humming so that when we need it in Dream Settler, I can just plug in the system.
Yeah, cool.
And so you're catching me at a good time to talk about this mm-hmm. because I've been thinking about it a lot.
Yeah.
In a really abstract sense.
Mark, you chose the topic.
I know. I just go with me with the fictional scenario.
Yeah. Sure, we'll take credit for it, yeah.
But yeah, I've been thinking about it in an abstract way.
Yeah.
So trying to think about, because I'm building this system for myself and for multiple projects I'm working on, but I'm also intending to roll it up and sell it on the Unity Asset Store.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the ulterior motive for it. I'm trying to like maximize my time by having it serve multiple projects and also maybe be a side hustle for me.
Yeah.
So that's me trying to be efficient with it. But it requires me to think extremely abstractly about what goes into these things. And I started by taking the save system from Widget Satchel and sort of filing off all the edges.
Yeah.
Okay. And there were a lot in there, actually. It's very specific to the data that Widget Satchel needed to store.
I believe it.
And so, because that was never intended to be abstracted.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking about it, thinking like, oh, I bet I could just almost 80% take it out. No, not really.
Oh, dang.
It didn't surprise me once I got into it, but before, just as I got into it, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is maybe a little bit less generic than I'd hoped. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you're doing a save data system, the one thing I'll say is that I have some learnings here from what I've been doing.
Yeah.
But I would say unless you are, I mean, there's a couple ways. You can get a third-party solution, and I'll be offering one soon mm-hmm. If you're a Unity developer. But I would also say don't worry about abstracting or genericizing your system all the time. I go in that direction a lot mm-hmm. for things I'm building, even if I am fairly certain I'm never going to use it for anything else. I mean, it's how I ended up, starting to build a Playdate game, but ended up with a game engine instead. It's a tendency I have, and I like it, and I want to make sure there's a point to that. But I think it can also be like a trap if you have nowhere else to put that energy.
Right.
So that's important for me to make sure I have somewhere to put those abstracted concepts and not just into one game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think, like a lot of things, it can be really easy to put the cart ahead of the horse, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think the first thing I want to talk about is like, what kind of data do you want to even track?
Oh,
like, what goes into save data?
Real good question.
Because I think it can also be it can be really easy just to say like, I'm going to save the player object.
Yeah.
And you have all this extra data associated with it.
Yeah.
Or it could be I'm going to save points and be very atomized mm-hmm. and then realize that, oh, you know what? I actually need a bigger object to store all these smaller objects inside.
Yep.
And I've been like reinventing the wheel 6 times to build these little save objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding that balance can be kind of tricky. And it really depends on the game you're doing, but that's really a strong part of game design.
Yeah.
Because when you want to think about like, if you have like a linear progress game, like it's a first person game,
yep.
like that's one thing. But what if it's a game where you have like player stats that you can change in a menu?
Yeah.
Well, do you save that when you make those changes or do you wait until you reach a checkpoint in the level to save those
right.
things? Mm-hmm. And that becomes like it's a UX thing, mm-hmm. right? And so sometimes you need to like, okay, does this setting go onto the player or does it go into the settings for the game?
Yeah.
And like I think a lot of those things you kind of assume will come to you naturally. But then once you have to decide, it's like, I actually don't have an opinion on this yet.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Well, in the way that games do it nowadays, is it's like all, it feels like magic. Just whenever you need something saved, it's saved for you
yeah.
a lot of the time. So
right.
you don't, like as a player, you don't have to think about it as much.
Yes, and occasionally games will have, there'll be like manual save will be a big part of their design.
Right.
And they'll have to really foreground it to the player
because
they need to, because there's a lot of conventions with this sort of thing.
Right, right, right.
I think that's fine. Mm. I feel like if you are like, if you want your game to feel like a lot of other games, then you can just feel free to just use all those conventions.
Yeah.
But if you want to move against them, I think you have to be very careful to make sure that the player will discover them.
Yes.
Because, you know, what a player expects is maybe different from what you would expect, like, when you started playing games, because things have changed a little bit in the last 15 years.
They have.
And certainly when it comes to things like player customization, which is usually part of save data, but also you, like, and it would be logical to undo that if you don't reach a checkpoint.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a things like assigning points on a skill tree or something. But also that could be frustrating for a player to have to do that over again.
Right.
Yeah.
And also their expectation might be that I did that not as part of gameplay, but as a separate process.
Yep.
Whereas you, the developer, think of that as preparing before you enter this zone or this boss fight.
Yeah.
And so you think of it as a part of the same system. The player may not think of it that way.
Right, right.
There's a lot of UX considerations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But yeah, there's... I think the only advice I have really is just to like think about it early.
Yeah.
Because it can also change how you make your game.
Yeah,
like
for sure.
Especially if you're doing something like a roguelike or where like replay and like procedural content or a replayability is a big part of your design. What you save and don't save and what you present to the player as permanent versus, you know, ephemeral changes how the game works.
Yes.
And I think the more you think about that, the more opportunity you have to come up with some interesting, novel gameplay approaches.
Yeah.
Instead of just sort of like, oh, this is how it works in these games, so I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah.
If you find like, well, what would happen if I just saved this? And like, oh, that actually changed a lot of other things. Mm. That's interesting. I'm going to go that way. Or that would ruin everything. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think
right,
it's
be intentional with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Be intentional.
Yeah.
And that's something we say about a lot of topics.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, sort of smaller point in that is like when you want to save. So this is like the autosave question. I think it's pretty standard to have autosave during like logical checkpoints in a game. Mm-hmm. I think forcing players to manually save is a game design choice, but you really have to justify it.
Yes.
I think I've seen indie games that do that as a way of like, it's retro. Like, that's not a good enough argument.
I agree.
Like it's a reason for it to be that way, but the design of the game itself doesn't justify it.
Right.
And so I think you do need to be, again, intentional about making those kinds of choices. Right. So just a standardized, you know, kind of thing, beat a level, save your progress, right? Mm-hmm. Easy peasy. But you also might want to do checkpoints based not on level progression, but on player time or on things that happen in a game. This is something we face in Widget Satchel, is when do we save whether someone has gotten achievements or not?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Because the sort of standard way it works is that you award an achievement, and then that achievement immediately is saved. It's immediately part of the system.
Yep.
And the way we did it in Widget Satchel, and I don't know if this is the right decision, but it's something that I kind of got attached to, is this idea that if you achieve something, there's some things in Widget Satchel that are not undoable.
Yeah.
Unless you restart the level. And so it feels to me that like if you were to get an achievement but then restart the level, then you could get it again.
Mm-hmm.
And because those stats are tracked, I think it's like if you hit the same bot 20 times.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember that.
Or maybe if you just hit 100 bots total. Mm. Something like one of those things where that number does reset when you restart to the last checkpoint, but if you had got the achievement already, what happens when you get it again? Mm. And I think the standard thing is nothing happens. You already got it.
Yeah.
But then if you go to your stats page, it doesn't show that you got it because the number is lower.
Right.
Or if you go to in Widget Satchel, because we release on Switch, the achievements are stored in the system.
Yeah.
And we call them feats. Mm-hmm. And there's a menu where you can see which feats you've achieved. And so if you were to see hit 100 bots, but then you go to your stats page and it says you hit 94.
Yeah.
That's a little confusing.
Right.
And so the way we handled it was when you get an achievement, the achievement pops up, but it doesn't save it to a third party system. So it doesn't save it to Steam or to Xbox until you reach a checkpoint and then all that is saved.
Yeah.
To which point you can't undo it, right? By restarting a checkpoint. I don't remember any players ever complaining about that because then they just get the achievement again.
Right.
But I think that is a little non-standard.
Yes.
And the reason I really wanted to do it that way was because of how much data we were surfacing in the stat screen.
Mm-hmm.
Even though not a lot of players visit the stat screen, it felt to me I didn't want to create that that
yeah, that friction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that, I remember thinking about that, and they're like, "Why? How is this not a problem in every game ever?" You know, because we were doing anything particularly special.
I mean, I suppose it depends on how you pick your achievements, right? I feel like a lot of achievements, well, we had a whole conversation on achievements, and no, I don't like them, but I think depending on like what achievements you do, I feel like a lot of achievements aren't like hit bots 100 times. But sometimes, I guess there are a lot of achievements like that. I take it back.
Yeah, we didn't do any of the like checkpoint achievements, which I agree with you. Those have no place in games.
Yeah.
But yeah, games have all sorts of the just stat tracking achievements.
That's true.
And on Xbox, you can actually see the progress bar.
Yeah.
If you program it in, the developer sets it up. Mm-hmm. You can actually see the progress towards that.
Yep.
And so that is actually kind of interesting. It's like, can that be taken back at all? Does that number get re-reported at any point? Mm-hmm. Are those more about platform guidelines and not necessarily about the SDK, like how that works?
Yeah.
And we haven't done the Xbox version of Widget Satchel yet, so I haven't dug too deep into that.
I think we had to do a little bit of that for Treasure Stack, but I wasn't in charge of it, so
yeah.
I don't know a lot of the details.
A lot of times those stats are like, they're not tracked at the per user level.
Yeah.
They're just tracked at the system level, and so or the game tracks it overall. Like how many times this ever happens in a game?
Yeah,
and therefore it makes sense to just award that right away. Mm-hmm. And I think there are maybe two or three achievements that in Widget Satchel which are like that for that reason. But yeah, there's a lot of them that get awarded, and then when the stat goes back, it doesn't save.
Yeah.
Or does, and then it doesn't communicate to Steam or wherever.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of interesting to me. And that is just, that's an example as to why, like, you know, when you want to save what you want to save and when you can get play. I mean, you can, if you don't do this right, you can softlock players and not even realize it, right? For all this sort of thing. One of the things we're talking about for Dream Settler is when we save things and again, what we save, because there are so many different systems in it. We have mini games that have their own like saves, high scores and stuff like that. And so we made a pretty broad decision that like there is only going to be one player save per experience, and if you have a mini game in that, that will roll back if you roll back, right?
Yep.
I think that's logical. That makes some perfect sense because it's you're still playing the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was asking about, like, how did you do it in the first game? Because Hypnospace Outlaw has a lot of the same sort of problems that are associated with it, and has a pretty good reputation for not having a lot of corrupted saves. Like, people have not complained about it.
That's good.
Which if you're a successful indie, that will those things will it will come up. I'll just tell you, it's definitely going to come up at least once.
Yeah.
But they had a pretty good time of it, and the solution for them was just they auto save every 3 minutes.
Ah. Oh.
And I don't like it.
Yeah. That's scary.
And Mike was like, yeah, I don't like it either. But we just it was our way of making sure we didn't do something backwards.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it's a good fail safe. So even though it feels kind of wrong, like, and we're gonna avoid it in Dream Settler, we're gonna be much more deliberate. But that is a good solution for when you just got to get it done.
Yeah.
It's like it's a blunt instrument, but it works.
Yeah, I suppose.
Right.
True.
And it also means that there are more potential problems because there's more opportunities for the player to stop the game in the middle of a save operation.
Yeah.
But if a save operation is 40 milliseconds, chances are incredibly low.
Yeah.
And if you're doing, and this is all get into in a minute, if you're write caching, then if it's something if the game breaks down in the middle of a save operation, it will not commit that to disk, and so you'll be fine.
Yeah.
It just won't save, right? Just saving every couple of minutes, it's like it feels icky, but it's a solution, and it's not a bad one. So if that's where you're at, if you feel like, I don't want to do this, it's too complicated, I don't know when this is going to, like, just go ahead and autosave every so often. That's totally fine. All right, so big high-level talk done.
Yeah.
So a lot of this is going to be specific to Unity development because that's what I've been doing lately, but also I think this applies in a lot of other places as well. Sort of like what is the actual format you save your data in?
Yeah.
And so I have a couple of different things that are Unity-specific, but they apply sort of elsewhere. The first one is very Unity-specific, which is player prefs.
Yeah.
We've talked about this in a recent episode because I've been dealing with this in a porting work I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
Player prefs is a very simple Unity utility that lets you just say, save a string, save an integer, and it just saves to a magic place, and you don't have to worry about it.
Magic.
And the saves are all stored by strings.
Yeah.
And you can't save Booleans for some reason, so it's just...
Yeah.
So if you want to save a true or false, you got to do ones and zeros.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very weird thing.
Well, that sounds amazing.
It's the worst.
Okay.
It gets the job done, you know?
Yeah.
I in the episode recently when I was talking about this, one of the things on Windows, it saves it to your registry. Yeah. That's why it doesn't save a Boolean, because a Boolean is just a one and a zero, but registry store hexadecimal numbers and ones and zeros.
Yeah.
They store them in hexadecimal format. Mm-hmm. But that's, I think, why that is. I think it's stored to a database file on OS X or Mac OS. Mm-hmm. And it's stored differently per platform. But the idea is that it's handled by the operating system rather than the game itself.
Yeah.
And I think structurally, this is a bad idea because you are saving values to disk rather than saving like a save game object.
Yeah.
It also means you have less control as to when you read and write that information.
Right.
You can change a bunch of values and then write it manually, or you could change values and have them write every time you change them. Mm-hmm. But it gives you less opportunity to have control over when these things happen. It's not terrible for like system settings, which you generally want to take effect as soon as they're entered.
Yeah.
In terms of a practical sense, it's not the worst. Mm-hmm. I still don't like it. Mm-hmm. And that's the porting job I was doing. That was what it was used as, was for, just not for player stuff, but for, you know, system settings.
Yeah.
And I needed to change all of that, I felt. And so it's tempting to use it because it's so easy and it works.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cross platform. Even consoles, if you're working on console ports, they have recently started to support player prefs.
Oh, really?
Which is bad news, I think, because it means more people are going to use it.
Uh-huh.
Because structurally, I don't love it.
I mean, it hasn't prevented people from using it in the past, I think.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, like, I had to get off my high horse a little bit and say, like, you know what? If it works for you, it works for you.
Yeah.
A medium horse.
Medium horse. I would say don't use this. I would say if you can avoid it. If it's going to increase the scope of your work to come up with another system, then go ahead and use it.
Yeah.
It's more like if, you know, ideologically I don't like it, but like, I'm like, don't work an extra 4 weeks just to get on that medium horse with me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's good.
And that involves any kind of system that included as part of your a game engine or a platform that is simple but kind of rudimentary and maybe not great. I would say go for it anyway if a practical sense, if you've got to.
Yeah.
But always know that you're making the wrong choice, but you're making it for a reason.
Right.
So don't apologize, but know that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Another common thing is XML or JSON. So yes. XML is a markup format. JSON is ridiculous, but
I'll take it.
It's a set of string tables.
Yeah.
But JSON and XML are essentially just nested strings. Mm. And you can store strings, you can store numbers and Boolean values as strings, and then they can be converted into the correct value, data types. It is, I would say, the most commonly recommended way to save data of all types in game development.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of reasons for that. It's really easy to handle versioning. So if you may update your game, whether during development or particularly after release, and you add a new value, you change the name of a value, you store something now instead of as an integer, you store it now as a float because you've decided you want more precision, you store three values instead of two, any changes you make, it's a lot easier to just have a variable that says version, which is just the version of your game. And then when you load up the game data, it's much easier to read the data of the old version because all you need to do is read the strings.
Yep.
You don't need to have the original data structure in your game anymore. You can just say, oh, this is what the old data file was. I'm now going to translate it to the new format just by some string operations.
Yeah.
Fairly simple, fairly easy. You could also do this manually. So if a player comes to you and says like, hey, I have a problem with my save game, then they say, send me the text file, because that's what it does. It saves it as a text file.
Yes.
JSON and XML are not easy to read for someone who's not a developer, but if you're like a modder or something, like you'll get used to it pretty quick. And a developer, it'll just be totally intuitive to you. And you can just change values. So modding is good for, if you do mods, that's a good way to interact with save data.
Yeah.
Is you're not using any actual APIs, you're just saving to the same data file. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to handle that. And if you're trying to fix a file, you know what it's supposed to look like because you can read it in a text editor.
You can encrypt JSON files too, right?
You can. So if you're trying to save, you know, what you're doing, you can obfuscate it, you can hash it, you can do all the sort of things you could do.
Because one of the disadvantages of this is, you know, people can just edit their saves, right?
Yes.
So I mean, they could, I guess, if they want the achievements or something, they could just edit the save and then get the achievements if that's how the achievements are unlocked.
Right. I mean, I'll put my foot down and say I don't care.
Sure. That's absolutely fair. I feel the same way.
And I will say, if you care about that, you're wrong. as a developer. Okay. Like, if you want to make sure that your players get it fair and square, uh-huh. like whatever, it's between them and God. Like you don't have to care.
No, I agree, but I think that there are certain and there might be some situations where you might want to encrypt your save for some reason.
There may be reasons.
Yes.
But I would say the normal reasons you think of
yeah.
are usually things you just, if you really think about it, you shouldn't care about. There's nothing there for you to protect. Now, when it comes to things like storing things on a player's disc that involves, like, if you are trying to, like, save a spoiler in the game,
yeah.
like, I mean, that also, who cares? Mm-hmm. But you might care a little bit more than if they're able to change their score.
Yeah.
You know? Things like that. Or you're trying to obfuscate data that you don't want people to extract mm-hmm. and reuse because you have the copyright to that data.
Yes.
You know, that's, I think that's more legitimate than trying to prevent people from, you know, cheating.
Yeah.
But that is one reason you might want to avoid a text-based format. The other reason is that it's kind of hard to put together sometimes.
Mm.
So in Widget Satchel, the game stores. So if you've played Widget Satchel, you know there's just piles of junk laying around that when Sprocket runs into, and it's really just, it's visual flourish, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's very few game mechanics attached to it, except for the levels that Ellen designed. and so it's part of the aesthetic of the game, it's part of the feel of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But because there are a couple of puzzles associated with it, and because I wanted the game to feel contiguous as you enter and leave it,
yeah.
and you can actually pile up junk and leave it there,
yeah.
right? And I didn't want that pile to go away if you came back to your save. And so it stores the value of the position and status of every piece of junk in a level.
Mm.
Thousands and thousands of vector threes.
Especially on the levels I made.
Yes. And so that is just, in a JSON file, it's not interesting to read that.
Right.
And it's enormous.
Yes.
The real problem is that actually translating that data is an operation step for each of those objects.
Mm.
Whereas if you save it in the next way I'm going to talk about, it's really just a matter of taking the binary piece of information and saying, put it on disk.
Yeah.
It's much easier for the developer. It's much faster at runtime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say the delta between doing it the hardest, most complicated, and longest way versus the simplest and speediest way is not a big delta.
Yeah.
You're not going to have a ton of performance differences. I think, you know, saving, and you'll see this a lot even before solid state drives, saving player data to disk does not take a lot of time.
Right.
A lot of times you'll see that whirligig in a game for longer than it's really supposed to be there for like assurances or to bring attention to the fact that it's saving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very frequently, you will see that saving whirligig in a video game for three times as long as it takes to actually do it,
mm-hmm. yeah.
just so you know it's happening,
right.
so that it communicates to the player. That's how fast these things generally are,
yeah.
even for very big, complicated games. It's not that big of a difference, but I didn't want to introduce any potential problems because who knows, the next level Ellen makes for us might have so much junk that it would actually be translating those all into you know, raw string
right.
data. Would
just
be...
imagine Super Widget Satchel.
Now I am.
So it's difficult to do. I think, I say difficult, but it's, you have to be a little more deliberate with it.
Yeah.
And when you're making your game and you get to that decision point where like, I better start saving this data.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't already thought about how you're structuring it and formatting it and how you turn what is essentially a bunch of custom data types into strings, integers, you know, Booleans,
yeah.
Very basic data types. You're gonna have to do a lot more of that. You're gonna backtrack that work a little bit
yep.
more. So yep. that is a reason why it's difficult, and it's kind of the reason I don't recommend XML or JSON generally.
What?
Yeah, that's my big twist. I would say like
that's what I told you to do. Okay. You know what? That's fair. You learn things better than me. So.
Well, so, I mean, it's, like I said, it's the most, if you ever go on a web forum and say, yeah. how do I save this data? Everyone just comes back to you, use the JSON formatter.
Yeah.
That's the way you do it. You got to do it. That's the way you do it. And I think there's nothing wrong with following that advice.
Yeah.
And that's why I went through all the reasons why it's a really good idea.
Uh-huh.
Because there's lots of advantages to it.
Yeah.
But I think those advantages don't necessarily outweigh the ease of use of saving data as in binary formats.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is taking the object in your game as it's stored in memory
mm-hmm.
And just serializing that to disk as a binary file.
Yeah.
It's much easier as a developer workflow. It's harder to do versioning,
yeah.
but that is a single process you go through. So making sure that it's going to work properly, that you keep it, that you're, it, rather than going through every piece of data you're going trying to save and making sure it's suitably written as a, you know, as it turned into something that's JSONable. I think that's a bigger process. It's a little bit more finicky. You might miss a thing. You might change. You got to change your mind a lot.
Yeah.
Especially as your data types change. I think storing the player save object as a binary file is that ease is. I think people underestimate that when they recommend using a string format.
Sure.
But there are some caveats, right? And this is one of the reasons why people don't recommend doing this. One is that the standard way to do this in C#. That is the .NET API that Unity uses,
right,
is the binary formatter, which takes an object and it serializes that to a binary file, and then you can take that file and you can put it on disk. Mm-hmm. Easy peasy. It works with everything. It's basically magic. Yeah. It's really, really nice.
Yeah.
But it will store things like functions and code, and it will store a lot of things that you should not be saving to disk if you care about things like security and white boxing and all the stuff that you would do about being a responsible software developer. Mm-hmm. As game developers, I don't think we care that much about stuff like this.
Well, I'm certainly not responsible.
Like, I mean, this is the thing where you talk like a bunch of speedrunners will talk about how they can execute code by using an NES controller. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff we're talking about, mm-hmm. basically. At that, it's not quite... You're not that close to the metal necessarily.
Yeah.
But essentially, the windows are a little bit cracked open for that kind of attack. And this is essentially for the developer. It's not necessarily that your application is going to be used to compromise somebody's operating system.
Yeah.
Necessarily. But your application will read a data format and then will execute code from it. And if the deserializer can do that, so there's potential there.
Yeah, sure.
It's very small, but it's very serious when it comes to the kind of software that the .NET framework is used all over the world by proper software developers making proper software.
Yes.
And so the binary formatter is officially depreciated in .NET and will be removed at some point.
Oh.
Now, good news for people using it is you can always use the old SDK, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
But if you're using Unity and you're kind of keeping up with things, Unity's version of the .NET framework lags a little behind the up-to-date one, which is probably a good thing, frankly. Mm-hmm. But so it'll probably be a couple more years before it's taken away from Unity developers.
Yeah.
But it's on the horizon.
Okay.
And so if you can avoid it, you should. If you can't, just like with player prefs, go for it. ignore everybody's warnings. Yeah. You're not making, security software.
Mm.
It's fine. So because it does work kind of like magic, consider how you're versioning your software, make sure that when you change your data structure, that especially if the game is live, that you can still read the old save files, make those translations, and then save the new version and make that seamless to the user.
Yeah.
That's really important. But the advantages for binary formats are it allows you to compress the data, which means that you can read and write it way faster. Mm-hmm. Again, these are not huge numbers, but
it's still something.
It's still something, right? If you're trying to save a little bit of time anywhere, it's a place you can save some time.
Yeah.
And if you are storing, if you have like a RTS or something that has just tons and tons of data, it is much more efficient to serialize it to a data format, compress it, and save it as less than a kilobyte instead of half a megabyte.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point.
Yes. And if you're making save operations lots of times, or you're on a console, which has limits as to how often you can access the disk before, certification will come back and say, hey, this is too much. You're going to wear out our systems. Mm-hmm. That is a consideration for that.
Yeah.
So how else can you save things in binary? How can you possibly do it?
Good question.
Well, there's a fancy new thing. And I say new, it's like a decade old.
Oh.
Called protobuf. It's a protocol buffers.
Oh.
Don't ask me what that means.
Okay.
It's a framework that was developed by Google over a decade ago. And the idea is to take data, binary data, and structure it more like XML so that all the sort of problems with binary formatter or those types of things are no longer apply.
Oh.
And so you can just feed it binary data and it will spit out serialized or deserialized objects that you can put to disk.
Okay.
And so it's not Protobuf is a framework for Unity. It's language agnostic, and so it's basically a philosophy and a framework and a system, and it's pretty well established. It's used in a lot of places, a lot of applications. There is a implementation for C# and .NET called Protobuf Net that has also been around for nearly a decade. Okay. Open source tool maintained by one person. It has contributors, but there's just one person maintaining it.
Right.
And they've changed the API to be much more familiar to .NET developers.
Oh,
so I've been using this a lot lately, and it's what I'm using in my save data system.
Yeah.
So that I can avoid using binary formatter, frankly. It's also incredibly fast.
Cool.
And the compression level is much better than using binary format. It's just better as well. It is a little, it's a lot harder to use.
Okay. Oh.
Because you kind of have to, so when you're using Unity, you have to mark things as serializable.
Yeah.
Like if you want to take a class, a whole class, and save it to disk, if the market is serializable,
yep.
That also lets Unity read it in the inspector and so on, but mm-hmm. that also lets you save it to disk.
Yes.
I think actually binary formatter might not care about that. But with Protobuf, you need to mark every single attribute within a class. You mark the class as a data contract. You have to mark each item as a member of that contract.
Oh.
And so it's a little complicated. And it stores, because it's very data efficient,
yeah.
It stores every object as an integer, as a table in an integer.
Okay.
Or an integer in a table.
Yeah.
And so... that keeps you really honest. So you're not going to, anytime you change your data structure, great, you've already assigned a number to that other thing. It's not going to mess it up, right? You'll assign a new number to this new thing.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to change the name of this. Doesn't matter. It's stored in the format as 5. So that doesn't change.
Okay.
So it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Now, cool. My problem for my generic system mm-hmm. is I want to make this easy for someone to use. So I have a whole set of challenges towards building that system without the user's input. And then making sure that they can still handle versioning properly.
Yeah.
So I have a whole separate problem with that. But I think for someone just using it, it does teach you a couple things as to how to sort organize your data in a really clever way. Mm-hmm. That I do wish you could store things as strings that it could take the name of and store it that way.
Yeah.
Because because I'm okay to take the performance hit on that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, those are my specific complaints. But it's it works a lot like the binary former, and you can feed it anything.
Okay, cool.
And if it's, I think you can't feed it actions or functions.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe you can. I'm not sure yet. I haven't tried that. It's not a thing you'd want to save.
Right.
This is another thing about deciding what to save. When you have a save data object, you could save the player object if you store all the variables on the player.
Yeah.
But then you're gonna have a lot of data that you don't need, mm-hmm. and you're gonna deserialize that object from disk, and then you're going to read like a third of its data mm-hmm. to rebuild the new player mm-hmm. When the game continues. So you want to be a lot more deliberate about that.
Yeah.
And what's nice about the way that Protobuf Net works is that you actually can be very deliberate about those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And also you have a good idea of what it is at all times instead of having the system decided for you. Mm-hmm. So that's quite nice. Cool. And so I recommend that if you don't want to use JSON format, if you are concerned about speed, protobuf.net is a way to go. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. It is a little hard to learn, okay. but once you got it figured out, it's actually really quite intuitive. So I think it's worth it. I'm going to be building this into the save data system I'm using. So when that's ready, I'll talk a little bit more about it and the considerations that I do for the user of my library versus someone who has to use protobuf.net directly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, I don't know, that's kind of the whole thing about formats.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of other ways to save to disk than the sort of two main ones.
Yeah.
And really, it's just about, I can't give a lot of recommendations on what to store or not.
Because that really just depends on how your game works.
Yeah, so the last topic on this is workflow, which is really, I just have one piece of advice on this, which is that, and this is why you don't want to use player prefs, is you want to have a save data object that lives in memory as your game is running. And then you want to save that to disk.
Yeah.
So you don't want to say save player.this and enemy.that.
Yeah.
You want to have all that data stored in player save dot whatever, right? You want the player to be unconcerned about that. You want the player to read the save data to determine its values. You don't want to save the player object. And that is just so you can keep all of your ducks in a row.
Yeah.
And it also means that you're only saving when you want to save. So all that stuff lives in memory. And then when you hit a checkpoint, you can put it to disk.
Yes.
Or if you're the type of game that saves the disk anytime anything changes, still a good idea because you're only saving the things you need to save. Mm-hmm. And so that also comes to like, how do you split up your save data? So you can have your save data as a folder and then a bunch of objects in it. Because let's say I want to always know. I want the player to be able to close the application anytime, but always know where they are on the map.
Yeah.
So I'm saving to disk the position on the map every half second. That's ridiculous,
yes.
But let's say you want to do that. Well, that's going to be its own file then, probably.
Yeah.
Because then you're not saving a ton of data. And the way you would structure it is you put it in a folder on the thing. And you can do that on any platform. You know, you just want to structure it that way. So again, it's about being deliberate and intentional about how you're going to do it. But always think about your save data as not things in your game you're saved to disk, but a save data object that lives in your game. And then occasionally you'll write and read from disk.
Yeah.
So you have a separate system to read and write that data versus to store and retrieve values from that object.
Yeah, it's a good.
Because I think that can get you a lot of trouble very quickly. Mm-hmm. Your save data becomes this enormous file way before you need it. And again, intentionality. I mean, you said that's the key word.
Right. No, and I think that particular is good advice.
Yeah.
Keep it separate. It's a lot of utility, as you were saying. It's good stuff.
Well, I've dragged this on for quite a while, but any questions?
I can't believe you don't use JSON. I understand why.
Are you at the altar of string
altar,
data?
Altar, no, but it's just easier. Yeah, and I like things easier with my coding. But I totally understand. And this Potter Bruff thing sounds interesting.
I don't think it's going to change your mind.
Probably not, but I can still look into it more. I don't know. I use GameMaker now instead of just Unity. I'm a new man.
Guys, Eric also got a shirt.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, he got the Nice Games Club shirt.
Oh, that's a good one.
It is a good one. Do you have one?
I have one.
Just one?
I have one and Dale has one. So in our household, we have two.
That's not fair. I only have one. I got my mom one.
Well, there you go.
Should get my dad one.
Well, where can Steven go to get a second, third, and many more?
Well, it's a really complicated URL.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's nicegames.club.
Nice games.
/.
Yep. Does that have what? Is that forward slash?
It's just your regular /.
See, that's the thing, is people always say forward slash. And I'm like, you don't have to say forward.
You don't.
I'm distracting. So go on.
There is another /, but no one uses that.
So, Ellen, there's more to this URL?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Nicegames.club/shirt.
Shirt.
Nice.
Okay. I wrote that down.
You don't need to put anything else.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
You know, that's what you got to remember.
Now, I'm convinced, but what could you say to someone who's like, I don't know about this shirt?
Well, you know, it's got a really cool logo on it.
It's true.
Designed by a guy named Mark.
Uh-huh. A professional.
Professional. And, you know, I think the thing that's really cool is it's like really classy. Because it's got like just the logo on the front. And then it's got little Nice Game stuff on the back. And like it's not really in your face about it. But you know what is really good to have in your face is the soft shirt.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah. So
I got to be honest. I was not prepared for how nice the shirt was when we decided to go with this supplier.
Yeah.
I was like, it looks good. It's got the heather gray I'm into. Cool. And then it arrived. I'm like, oh, it's nice.
Yeah. You just rub your face all over it like you're a cat or something. You know?
Yeah.
It's really good. Which is actually, you know, if you are a person who has a partner, get the shirt for your partner so you can hug them and get your face on that nice shirt.
There you go. True. Free pillow.
Basically. And it does come in heather gray, but it also comes in heather blue.
Yeah.
Which you don't see very often.
No, you okay. Well, see. Got ideas now. Go on to nicegames.club/shirt. Checking out these shirts.
I mean, holidays.
All the different colors.
Holidays are like here.
Holidays are here. Oh.
We did a whole shirt spot. And we didn't talk about. Oh, man, all right.
Okay. Well.
Nicegames.club/shirt.
All right.
No, wait. You got to try to scare me again.
I don't want to scare you anymore, Ellen.
You're too good at it.
I'm really good at it.
I don't know if you can do it as well as you did the other two times.
Trello is down.
That's just a bummer. It's not scary.
All right. I'm not as good at it.
I'm taking it. That's what we're using. My topic is interdisciplinary communication. Mm-hmm. Why did I pick such a wordy title? Just to have Ellen say it? That's part of the reason.
I nailed it during the intro.
You did, actually. You did. I was a little disappointed.
sorry. But,
I am the only programmer in Future Club, and so I oftentimes have to talk about my code to artists. And, they don't code, so it's hard for them to be like, it's hard for me to describe all the work that I'm doing and make it feel like I'm actually doing work. So that's part of the problem. But in the same vein, I am not an artist. I don't draw and stuff. So like when people are like, oh, I did this thing, I'm like, wow, art's cool. But like, I don't know how they did it. I don't know what the format is in or anything like that, which is probably bad because I'm their only programmer and I should know what the format is. So
there's that nexus between the technical expertise that you both need.
Yeah, but like, exactly. Yeah. And neither of us have it. So I wanted to talk about that with y'all because I don't know. I'm curious how y'all are going about it at your jobs and not jobs. And I guess I'll just talk about my own experiences too. And I think also in the same vein of this, like, you know, I have some game design experience, but I'm not the game designer on my team. So like I still have to communicate with our game designer to talk about like how these things are going to go into it, but I don't have the full idea, big picture about how all the systems come into place and things like that. So like sometimes I'll be like, oh, I need to implement this thing this way, I guess. Should I? I'll ask the designer, and then be like, no, actually, you need to do it this way and this way and this way, and then I have a better understanding of it. And that's a little bit easier for me because I have that background knowledge as to why they would want to do it. But it's still valuable to just have these skills. And so I guess like way I've had handled like talking about things other people don't know anything about, is like I've sent them examples of like code or like what the code can do. I've tried documenting things. I'm getting better at that.
All right.
meetings, like an explainer thing where you just like share your screen and point out stuff. That's been helpful. More meetings, just yeah, meetings. Actually, meetings are great for these things, for this purpose in particular.
Good meetings are great.
Yeah. Good meetings are great. Great meetings are better. And then DMs, you know, on Slack or Discord or whatever you do your business on. I hope you don't do your business on Discord. You probably do your business on Discord too, I guess. Some people do.
A lot of people do, but Slack and Teams are pretty common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're more focused on it. But Discord for small teams works fine.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I was saying that, but like we use Discord.
Like, well, yeah, but we're not.
No, no, no. I'm talking about the team I'm on.
Oh,
it didn't.
Oh, really?
I was like, oh, right. Yeah, we just we don't even have it. We just have a private DM that has four people in it.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah,
okay.
That's
you
all
have
it is.
Separate channels.
And then we have a Discord server that we talk with our publisher.
Yeah,
that has some categories.
Yeah,
and then the porting team that's working on the first game and handling their bug reports and stuff.
Oh, so,
but like, yeah, I remember thinking like, oh, this is going to be tricky. But our team is so small.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
That it kind of works. But I was like, yeah, go ahead and use Discord. I'm completely forgetting that that's how I get by.
That's wild to me.
Because we, a Nice Game Club, we use Slack for us.
We do.
To organize.
But I mean, like, we could get away with using Discord.
We certainly could.
Basically everything we only have one channel that we talk about.
Yeah, but it's for the same reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, I just can't imagine working on a thing and having separate channels for stuff.
I would have, like, kicked some dust up, but I was new at the time.
Oh,
like,
okay.
You know what? I'll see. And then by the time I felt like I could kick up some dust, I decided it didn't matter.
Okay. All right. Well,
yeah, right.
I mean, okay. That's a strategy. Well, I suppose actually, you know, what's interesting about that is like you get exposed to everybody's content and all their conversations. Well, theoretically, I suppose some people would have, you know, separate DMs if they need separate things and you don't need to hear about it or other people don't need to hear about it or whatever.
Well, that's the thing about our project is that all three of us need, not necessarily need to, but it is useful for all three of us to know everything the other two is doing.
Right. Yeah. And so
we all weigh in on each other's choices.
Yeah.
And and it's like, I'm going to do it this way. Thoughts?
Yeah.
And then, so we do a lot of that.
Exactly. And that's fascinating, right? Because sometimes I will have those kinds of things. Like the way that I'm formatting the way that like this code works or something isn't quite working the way I want it to in Game Maker, Unity, whatever.
Yeah.
I will sometimes go to the team and be like, how should I approach this? But I have to figure out a way to communicate that. So it's not like, how should I write this function so that it uses the right variables? You know, I'm not describing all that. I'm just describing the issues that I'm having and why this would be an issue for things down the line. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to communicate that in a way that other people can understand. Mm-hmm. And this is like that section of what's it called, soft skills, people want you to have at your job, but they don't train you to do.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess this is the conversation starter, right? Is mm-hmm. like this is the jump into it. You're going to want to learn all these things because, like, odds are you're not going to be the only developer. Even if you are the only developer, you sometimes need to communicate these problems to other people because you're on the Unity forums and you're like, this specific thing doesn't work. Or you're on Game Maker's Reddit and this bug has been plaguing me for 3 weeks and I don't know how to fix it.
Are you speaking from experience?
Right. You may be a person who might do something like that.
Right. So if you are, you need to be able to communicate these kinds of things. And so I think the ways I found to do that is like you break it down into simple, like easy enough for people to understand outside of programming. And then like they will give you answers and you can translate that into code speak. Mm-hmm. And same thing with art. Like I'm not an artist, so I have a hard time explaining what I'm looking for from a particular art piece or something like that. But I can look up examples of art that I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or I can try to describe it. And then the artist can be like, oh, is this what you mean? And they'll talk about it or sketch something out. And I'll be like, yes, that's it. Or no, that's not it. And then, you can have a back and forth. So, like, I think part of it, frankly, is with these kinds of conversations, is just starting the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard, too, because when you don't know what you're talking about or what you're asking for, you can feel foolish coming to somebody and being like, please, artist, what kind of circle?
One art, please.
Can you make it look more, dynamic?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. Because, like, there's that connection between disciplines
right.
can often overlap in a way that you don't expect it to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, like, you're asking for things from an artist, but what you're actually asking is for them to be a tech artist and you to be a tech artist.
Yeah.
Like just for a moment.
Right.
Just for 5 minutes, you both need to be one thing.
Yes.
But you're both talking and so but it's hard to realize that sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think what you need to do is you need to what do you need? And then express it in a way that will make sense to that person.
Yes.
But a lot of the preamble to that is explaining what you're going to do with it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Because here's the best part about this that I think a lot of people don't realize
mm-hmm.
is you can explain to somebody what you need and why you need it.
Yeah.
In your own language.
Right. Yeah.
And they'll be able to understand it in their language.
Yeah.
Like it's not necessarily, and what's great about that is that then they will have some ideas.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like, oh,
yes.
If the reason you need that is because of X, then I will take my knowledge and background and understanding to provide you with X.
Yeah.
Using my talents, even though you didn't ask for that.
Yes.
Right.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's that kind of stuff. You got to, if you can explain the purpose of it, then people can understand you and however you're describing it. Then mm-hmm. you can start talking about variables and functions and all this other junk. And they'll be like, yeah, I guess if you use this thing and this thing, it'll work out just fine. If you do blah, blah, blah. You
got to do, when it's two programmers talking,
yeah.
you got to do that. Because that's the thing we're doing on DreamSet, where Mike and I will talk back and forth because we're working on different systems.
Right.
And then suddenly they need to talk to each other.
Yes.
And then I need to explain to Mike how I built this system that he hasn't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to describe to me the system he built that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
And we need to decide what's the best way to link them up.
Yeah.
And we're basically coming from two different worlds.
Right.
Even though we're speaking the same language and writing the same language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have a giraffe, he has an elephant, and you have to make sure that he understands you have an elephant without him being able to see the elephant.
Right.
Yeah.
Or I've ever heard of an elephant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good way of describing that. Did you just come with that up on the fly? Because like that's...
Totally. No, I did not.
Oh.
No, there's like, it's kind of, I was just thinking it's based on this, the way that like if you, it's like a story or like an aphorism or something that if you like take a blind person and let them feel one part of an elephant.
Yeah.
They feel the trunk, they'll think an elephant is like a big long noodle,
mm.
right? Because like that's probably very reductive to people who do not have sight. But like the idea being is that if you're only giving people like unlimited access to the thing,
right.
then they will have an incorrect concept.
So you got to give them the big picture.
Right.
Well, there's another way to take that metaphor, which
yeah.
is that you don't need to burden someone with the knowledge of the whole elephant.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
all they're going to be doing is, I don't know, plugging a cord into its nose. I'm trying to figure the metaphor out.
Uh-huh.
But if they just need to interact, if they just need to interact with the trunk.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Then
and they don't need to know
about the rest of the elephant.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. True. Because you're the one who can then evaluate, like, is this going to work for the whole elephant? So there's maybe there's a little back and forth, but in terms of efficiency's sake, sometimes you just want to trust them to know only as much as they need to know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And not burden them with more knowledge that then they'll start making decisions that you should be making.
And that's an important part of it too, is that trust aspect. Mm-hmm. Because as I'm the only programmer, I'm the expert in programming. I'm using quotes. Uh-huh. I am the expert. That's why they hired me, but I'm using quotes
is as an audio podcast, yeah, people at home won't realize you're doing that.
Yeah.
And so that they'll think that you're really serious and what you're talking about.
Right. Exactly. So I wasn't using quotes.
Who's editing this?
So they have to come to me when, they need code advice or something, that don't quite understand how this works, or like they need a feature in or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they are trusting me with my expertise to help them through this thing, or create a task so I have to do this later or something like that.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I don't know art, so if I need like a UI or something, I have to go to the people who can do that for me, because I cannot do that myself. Mm-hmm. I can make something really crappy looking so we can test it.
Yeah.
But that's about it. I defer to people who are more knowledgeable about that. And it's important for you as a coworker, teammate, partner, what have you, to, defer when necessary, when it's appropriate, when somebody else has more expertise about a certain thing. And even in this particular case where you're talking about, Mark, where like, a particular part about the code and Mike knows a particular part about the code. You defer to Mike about like the things he knows about specifically and things like
that. Oh, yeah. You have to, just in the interest of your own time,
yeah,
you have to be like, I'm not going to learn this whole other part of the application.
Yeah.
Because there's someone over there doing a great job with it.
Exactly.
Like, mm-hmm. I just need to give them what they need from me. And then I do not, because I'm not going to burden myself with that whole elephant.
Yes. Yes. Elephant's back.
But an important part of that, when you're talking about, especially as you sort of like do a little self-deprecation about like you being the expert,
right,
is you do need to be really, one, confident in, mm-hmm, that if you are the one who knows about these things, then you are the expert.
Yes.
But also you need to be really honest and open and say, like, if you actually are like having trouble,
right,
and there's no one else to go to,
right,
you need to let the people who you need to interact with know,
yeah,
I'm having some difficulty with this. I don't know this system as well as maybe I should, or maybe I will.
Mm-hmm.
So sit tight.
Yeah. I'm being super open with learning Game Maker.
Or being like, I don't know how this works, so can we do it a different way?
Yes.
And that, because the person you're talking to, like, they know nothing about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not going to be worried. You're already constraining their what they have to do.
Yeah.
So, don't force yourself into a situation, especially if you're trying to do things the right way.
Yeah.
Do it the way you can do it, the way that you and the people you're working with can work the best together.
Yep.
And if that means you need to learn something new so you can make things easier for them or make things better for the project,
yeah,
that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could do a workaround, or you could take the knowledge that you have and guide the other people to make it easier for you, mm-hmm, go for that.
Yeah.
There is no one right way, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. With all things games, there's just so many ways you can go about things that it makes it flexible for you to be able to do it the way you want to do it, mm-hmm, and the way that makes most sense for how your game is working.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really good.
And all these things work together. So the more that they're – the way they interact with each other, the more that they're thought of as a part of this project and not part of any project,
yeah,
the more deliberate the whole thing will be, and the more connected and holistic the whole systems will all be together,
mm-hmm,
because they were the interchange between those two components was designed together by those people,
yeah,
rather than just saying, well, this is the kind of thing this needs and that's the kind of thing that needs, so let's both figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
Like, if you can't meld minds, like, the next best step is to actually just, work with what you've got,
yep,
to come up with something together.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of having to, like, square peg round hole kind of it, right?
Yeah. I was just reminded of that video where he's like, that's right, it goes in the square hole. Anyway.
Yeah. I hate that look video. At this triangle one. It goes in the square hole.
Yeah. That being said, all of this stuff, it's great information, but this doesn't always work, because sometimes people need more attention, not just because like they're not understanding a thing, but because like they might need more features than what you're providing them,
yeah,
or more information than what you're providing them. And so like you might have to have more conversations about it. And a lot of these things take time, right? You can't just be like 5 minutes, go, this is how this works now. Okay, go to it. You gotta Yep. Sometimes you got to sit there and explain it for an hour.
Yeah.
And it takes some time, but then people understand it and then they can use that information. It's better to spend that hour now than to spend 5 hours fixing a problem mm-hmm. later.
Yeah.
So it's valuable to do that. But also, I mean, sometimes it's difficult for people to pick up on these things right away because their minds work differently. And so, like, you might want to, you know, just take time for people so that they can better understand it for their own sakes.
You gotta try different things, and if your elephant metaphor doesn't work, then you go with something like a beluga. I don't know.
Exactly. I've had a lot of conversations around like Git and mm-hmm. version control when I first
on
started.
On purpose?
No. Most definitely no. But we needed version control because we're a team, and people are going to be working on the same project.
If there's one thing that visual artists have the hardest time understanding conceptually,
yeah,
it's Git.
Yeah.
It took me a long time because I came from as a visual
artist. Right.
Because I had my own way of tracking files.
Yeah.
And man, it took me a long time mm-hmm. just to like unlearn some things.
Yeah.
And so I now have to do things two ways because they are totally different when I do art versus code.
Yeah.
But man, that's hard for people to wrap their minds
around. It is very difficult. Yeah. Like I totally understand. And so like you have to take time to explain it. And like sometimes you can go about it. It depends on different people. Some people want to know how the whole thing works so that they can use that information to better make decisions down the line.
Yeah.
Some people want to just know how to push something up to the repo, and that's all they need to know
right.
for the time being. And that makes sense too, because like that might be the only thing they do for 5 months, so they don't need to have that other information. So it always depends on the situation. Situational, it's always.
Yeah.
That should be our mantra.
It depends.
Yes, it depends. And playtest.
I think the best question to answer though is always why.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Someone doesn't need to know the how necessarily, or even the what all the time. Mm-hmm. But if they know the why, then they'll be better prepared for like the next time you need an interface.
Right.
Or they'll be able to figure out. They'll be able to guide their work closer to what you need before they ask you the question.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And if they can run into issues, they know it's an issue and not they don't know that it's not an issue if they're actually an issue. That's a weird, vague way of saying it, but it can be a problem really quickly. Another thing I want to bring up is documentation. I think Mark's going to hate me for saying this. I think.
Getting ready.
Documentation is nice in a vacuum, but sometimes you need to do things outside of documentation, and just having the words and the information to use isn't always going to help people be able to implement the stuff that they need to implement.
Right. So you're talking about like also doing drawings and stuff to make things clear.
sure, Mark.
Well, I'm actually really curious what you're talking about, though.
Well, okay. So I think part of it is my documentation skills are not great. Mm-hmm. So I'm still working on it. But like I feel like I've been documenting a lot of like the variables and the functions that people can use to code things. Because they have to do their own code sometimes mm-hmm. now with some of the things that we're working on. But I think that it's difficult to like see all of the different functions that you can use. And if you don't have that or coding knowledge, be able to convert that into an actual functional usable thing.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like you can see all the functions and all the functions are well documented. You know all the variables that go into it. You know exactly what this function does. You know exactly how this function works. But if you don't have that background, it's difficult to be like, oh, I can take this function, use it in a loop, and get access to all these different things and then convert things that I need or whatever.
You're talking about there's one thing to document the use of something,
yes.
and then there's one thing to document like the using it as parts for something new.
Exactly.
Right? And that's the level of documentation you provide is going to be different.
Right.
You are not likely to need to do that second order documentation except for yourself.
Yeah. Right. And so
you should still do it though. Because for yourself. But I get your point.
I've taken the habit of like creating examples for people to be able to see how these are like implemented.
Yeah.
Well, that's really useful.
Yeah. I think it'll help people like see a use case and be able to change it as they go on.
Especially if you're teaching people who are going to need to interface with that code but are not developers on the project necessarily,
yes,
but need to sort of like play act for a moment.
Yeah.
Example. That's a great idea. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Thanks. Glad I came up with that too. Really good at coming up with ideas.
Well, because the learning by doing is coded into that. So
yes.
if they have an example, then they can figure it out on their own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a way, I mean, you are, it is documentation of another sort, essentially. Yeah. But it's more interact. It requires a little bit of from them, but they'll get so much more out of it.
Right.
That's a really good strategy.
If you teach a person to fish and all that.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like we touched on the really important things. It's, break it down. Tell them about the why, what the purpose of this thing is. And it goes for all disciplines. It's not just coding.
For sure.
That is what I do on my day job. But, like, you know, I've had to have these conversations with people outside of just code. And it's all important stuff.
Well, I want to hear a little bit about Ellen. You interface with a lot of programmers.
Yes. Yeah, I'm coming at it from the opposite angle.
Because you're a designer.
Yeah.
And so I'm really curious how that conversation happens the other way.
Yeah, well, actually, it's the same. It's the same. Okay. It's just the things that are getting put into the examples and everything are just different. So the team that I'm working with now, mm-hmm. I don't touch the code.
Right.
I don't touch the code. It's a platform. Like, it's predates my time at the company by several years, and it's a software as a service, and it's got like CMS property that's very complicated, and I don't touch it.
There's probably not a lot of per project, a lot of custom code that happens at all per project.
Well, I don't want to
go. A little, I imagine.
I don't want to go too. I mean, there's some custom code that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, it's, yeah.
I imagine also there's probably some code feature development that happens outside the needs of an individual project.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. But then some features are developed specifically for, you know, a client or a customer, and then they become integrated. You know, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. The project management could be its own like case study in Agile, and I like talking to Eric about it a lot. but that's not what we're talking about here. No, for sure. Like, I solve a design problem. Mm-hmm. The client has said, we want something more like this. And the first thing I do is I try to understand what they mean. Right. Okay, so what problem are you trying to solve is a good question to use there. If that sounds like it's going to be too, like, it's just like, okay, so help me understand what being able to see this player data will enable you to do from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So you want to redo this thing. Sometimes it's obvious why they're asking for something. Sometimes it's not obvious. But I try to understand where they're coming from if it's not obvious. And even if it is obvious, I usually try to confirm.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, they're coming at it from a completely different perspective. So then if I need to do a little bit of prototyping or diagramming or wireframing, then I do that. If I need to work through some examples of how we might be changing or altering a scoring system, then I'll do that and I'll put it in the score documentation, mm-hmm. in the game design document. I'll update it and be like, this one, we added this update or we changed these things at this time. I'll create a new version of the document. And when I change the rules, I almost always do a worked example, mm-hmm. in the document,
yeah.
so that I can come back to it by myself later and remember how it worked, but also so that I can pull from that example if I'm trying to help developers understand. Mm. So that's what I do, taking the information from, you know, the stakeholders and turning it into a design. And then when I'm helping other members of the team work from that change, then I really make sure that I write very clear backlog items, exactly what needs, like what the current state is, what the future state is, and like how you can tell that it worked.
Yeah.
And sometimes that'll be, again, just like really clear writing. Or it'll be, I often do like really ugly wireframes, mm-hmm. like just like showing what the functionality is. And sometimes, I mean, sometimes I want to make it interactive, but usually unless we're designing something and we're at the early stages where we're really trying to work on like the feel of a thing, mm-hmm. I actually feel like it's really helpful if I just break it down like click by click or action by action,
yeah.
into this like small wireframe that just like does this really detailed like beat by beat, step by step of what the player would be doing and how the game reacts to the player.
Yeah, that's
good. Yeah, and a developer can take that and they can follow it like an instruction set.
Exactly.
And then it can be refined back and forth later.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, basically like here's the logic that I'm describing and this is what will happen. Like, you can see what it would look like. And that takes a little bit more time, but it's really, the feedback I've received is that, at least from developers, it's very clear.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And then, you know, you have these ugly wireframes. You can easily go, like QA can look at those and they can check to see if it's working properly, and the client has access to the backlogs, like they can look at the sprint backlog and see if the, you know, if they have any questions before, you know, things get shipped or whatever. So
yeah, it helps to have something that you could then a validator after the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it meet this, that it made sense? It's interesting.
Yeah.
But actually, what interests me most about you're talking about that, because you're sort of coming at it from two angles. You have client relation,
mm-hmm.
and whereas they're doing the communication to you, and mm-hmm. you need to figure out what they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and they're experts in literally nothing. And so I can say that because I've had a lot of clients over the years, and it's true. And yeah, you said you need to know what problem they're trying to solve, right? But
always.
Then you need to turn that into designer speak, and then you have to give that in a way that a programmer can turn into programmer speak.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what is interesting about that is it made me think about that client relationship. It's a lot of the same skills.
Oh, for sure.
But you and the programmer, or Stephen, in your case, you and the designer, you and the artist, you're sort of mutual clients of each other.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Well, team members.
It's more complicated, and the it's less of like a give me a problem and I'll solve it. It's let's solve a problem together and how to do it. But a lot of the same things are required.
Yeah.
It's like I need to explain to you a little bit on how I work so that you can communicate better to me what you need.
Yep.
Yep.
And that happens on the other side as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, like hopefully you have good client relationships and you want to help them solve the problems that they're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Maybe if they're trying to solve a problem that you don't think is a problem, you can have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I have. We're pretty open about it. It's a really good relationship. But yeah, you don't want to, just like you don't want to mouth off to your clients, you don't want to mouth off to your teammates. Like, you have to trust your teammates. Otherwise, you can't do creative work together, period.
Yeah.
Like, it'll break down eventually, and it's not fun, and it's not good, and it's making games that should be fun and good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess one of the things that I do is I often just try to start any like presentation that I'm doing to like a visual designer or to someone who's touching the code, like a programmer, is I'll say like, okay, this is like the high level summary of what we're changing.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's a one sentence summary of why we're changing it. And this is what I'm thinking about what we should do about it. What feedback do you have for me? You know, so like I don't view my role as a designer as like someone who hands down game design edicts to the rest of the team to implement. Like, that's not the relationship that I want with people I work with and you. But like I see my role as the person who is responsible for keeping the systems in my head, but also like being able to speak enough of people's different languages and empathize with these different perspectives, including the player's perspective, that I can find the right balance point between everything and then get everyone on board about that's the balance point.
Yeah.
And if it's not the right balance point, like make sure that I'm actually taking some time to validate that. So I always try to ask for feedback on solutions that I've come up with all the time because I don't have everything in my head. And everyone else is bringing different expertise.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'll just say, like, this is my take on it. Here's what's important to me about this. But, like, the rest of the stuff I have in here, this is just an idea. So if you want to change it, go ahead. Overall, like, what feedback do you have? Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. Do you think I should change something? Like, where do we go? And that's always really good.
I think what I'm hearing in that is a really important thing that when you are an expert in an area and other people aren't and people are depending on you.
Yeah.
So in your case or in Stephen's case,
yep.
The last thing you want to do is use that as an opportunity to carve out a fiefdom.
Yes.
Oh, because you literally can, right? I'm the only one who can do this. So I get to make some decisions about how it's put together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what you're describing is you want to make sure that you don't compartmentalize all your design decisions away from everybody else's influence just because that's your expertise.
Yeah.
And that's why you're asking for feedback all the time.
Yeah.
So that everyone comes along with you, everyone understands, and there's no surprises.
Yeah.
And I think it can be very tempting to be like, this is my area. It takes so long to explain it to people. I'm just going to take their inputs and take care of it. But that two-way street is really, you have to remember that's still needs to happen.
Yeah.
And it can be very frustrating when you're dealing with someone else and their expertise is something you don't have. And then they've carved out their little fiefdom.
Right.
And then they give you something that, like, you know, you would make a bunch of different choices on if you had had conversations earlier.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing in you just really a systemic way to avoid that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I try to, I mean, we have our daily scrums. We do lots of, you know, conversation with devs as a team.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like sometimes if you aren't taking up too much of somebody's time, grab someone, do a huddle on Slack, whatever platform you're using, and say, hey, I'm thinking about this and I don't know if I need to think about it anymore. Like, can you help me with this? You know, just like do some thought partnership. And be mindful of the time that they have. And like, you don't want to interrupt if they're in the flow state, like you really don't want to interrupt that.
Yeah.
But you know, like I think you both said this a couple of times throughout the conversation is like a little bit of investment in conversation and communication early can help with a lot of bug fixing down the road. I think the only other piece that it's worth saying in terms of how I approach collaboration is check for understanding often, right? Mm-hmm. And that sometimes can go, it doesn't have to be as like direct as, do you understand what I'm saying? Or like, does this make sense to you? Or what, you know, what questions do you have? It can be, you know, listening for like vocal feedback, like just, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Oh, I like that. You know, like just listening to some confirmation, not just like someone has received a task from you, like you handed off a boring box, but like they are invested in the solution that you're describing and the solution that you're trying to work for.
Yeah. The thing that I'm getting from this conversation from the two of you who are multidisciplinary in other Absolutely. Parts of your lives, yep. but in your current roles at work are focused in one area.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who is multidisciplinary in my current position, but also just generally everything I do, mm-hmm. It's a lot of the same things. It's when you talk to somebody about not always about an area that they know versus an area you know, mm-hmm. but just what they're doing versus what you're doing.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, I it makes sense that there's some connection, but I'm hearing the as you're describing it is like I do all the same things mm-hmm. when I'm talking to people who have my exact expertise.
Yeah.
Or I'm talking to people who are working on something that I'm not, but I have expertise in.
Yeah.
A lot of the same things apply.
Yeah.
Even when you do have that shared understanding, you still need to work at the sort of the moving together in parallel.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, the time, this is not just human communication patterns, right?
Yeah.
So like the time you're early with a team, you haven't spent much time with them, you might pause for confirmation like a little more and you might overshare sometimes the information.
Yeah.
And then you ask for feedback and they say, you can even ask for direct feedback. They're like, hey, so I'm new to the team. Was some of that repetitive? Like, do I need to cut any of that out or was most of it useful? And they'll say stuff like, oh, no, that was all great. You're fine.
Yeah.
most of the time. But, you know, the fact that you are asking for that level of feedback is also something that helps build trust with your team members.
Right. Yeah.
Because they know that they then know that you're open to it.
Yes.
So I think it's good to do that. And over time, you'll learn what they need and they'll learn your patterns and you'll naturally adjust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I'll. Stephen, we're coming with ways to extend this topic because it's so interesting.
Yeah.
But a question for both of you, because
yes.
from the work that I do, the thing that, and my instinct is when I'm working with someone who's working on something that I'm not working in,
yeah.
or in an area of expertise that I don't have,
yeah.
my go-to strategy is to become invested in what they're doing.
Okay.
And become interested in their area of expertise.
Okay.
But I feel that might be individualized because my next move is to then learn it myself.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that's certainly maybe not the most efficient way to do things. But do you think, I feel that that is useful for me to help with that communication. Mm-hmm. The more I am interested in learning what they're doing, the better feedback I think I can provide.
Sure.
And the more engaged I'll be and more willing I'll be to go along with them into the dark areas I don't know.
Okay.
Hmm. But I don't know if that's a good strategy for everybody.
It depends on how your mind works. And this is like, I think it's outside of like disciplines at this point. I think
yeah.
it's just how you take to information and how you are interested in other people's information.
Yeah.
The way I like to do it is I'm not interested in that many things. So, so if somebody comes to me with something that they're asking for my input and I don't care, then I turn it into something that I do care about, and I guess that's kind of what you were doing. But you're yeah. like you're approaching it in a way that, like, yeah, I guess I'm approaching it in a way that like makes it so that like this is more applicable to me. So for instance, my brother is looking for a house right now.
Cool.
I think it's fine that I can tell him that this whatever. If my brother has an issue with it, he has to listen to the podcast to know about it. I'm not interested in buying a house at the moment. So like my brother will come to me and be like, what do you think of this house? I'll be like,
it's got a door.
Yeah, it's got doors, I guess. There's walls. But I've been
Is there a roof?
Mm-hmm. There is, yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Uh-huh. But so what I've been doing is I've been adjusting my mindset and changing it so that like I'm looking for specifics of things that I do like about like my living situation and how I like it. So like for instance, I would appreciate having a gas stove. Because I just like gas stoves over.
It's better.
Yeah. Over electric, in my opinion.
Okay. As an environmentalist, we'll have to have this conversation later.
Yeah. But
okay.
No, I agree. Environmentally, it's bad. But anyway. So, you know, like things like that. I'll take things about what I'm interested in about houses.
Yeah.
And about living situations, and then bring that back and give my brother that feedback. And then he can use that information, which is different from like my parents' information or his own information.
Right.
He can take all of that knowledge and then decide on, you know, what houses he's interested in as a result of that.
Yeah.
So that was a long-winded way of saying,
yeah,
converting things.
There's a kind of, I mean, because I find myself sort of supernaturally curious. So,
sure.
Like, and I just don't know that everybody else is.
Yeah, you lean into that.
It's also kind of tedious sometimes because, like, I think. It's like, I don't need to know about what you're doing, but,
yeah.
Like, but I will put some time into that.
Yeah.
And like, that's not going to be super effective. But yeah. I think what you're describing is like finding a way to like link the puzzle pieces together.
Yeah.
And so you need to do a little bit of shaping.
Yeah.
But you don't need to completely reinvent yourself.
Yeah.
In that conversation.
Yeah. Right. You recognize that this is a conversation that you want to be engaged with.
Yes.
Even though the content of the conversation is not engaging you. So you create like a context or paradigm in your head to help you like be interested in it.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And some of that's empathy, but it's not all empathy, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's an empathetic skill. It's a skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like it's an empathy enabling skill.
Mm.
Yes.
For me, I am often curious about lots of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm also often very pressed for time.
Yeah, you're disciplined in a way I'm not.
Perhaps. That feels so wrong.
Yeah. Well, you don't know how undisciplined I am.
Yeah. So I'm just really invested in the outcome. I really just want everyone to be able to make a really good game.
Yeah.
And I think for me, like the thing that I love the most about making games isn't the game that we make; it's the process of making it together with other people.
Right. Yeah. Right.
100%. So like.
Yeah.
That helps me. That really is what it is.
Right. Wanting that to be successful is as good as being interested in what someone's talking about.
Yeah. I'm interested in what they're talking about because it's them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, that's how I'm approaching it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I guess I'm not getting as specific of like, I'm thinking about what I like about my house. It's just like, oh, yeah, you know, Rashad was talking about this thing. And yeah, I want him to be able to solve this problem successfully. So let's figure it out.
Yeah.
You know? So I, become interested in whatever everyone else is doing because they're doing it and they're talking to me about it, which is a little bit, I feel like, of a brain hack, but you know, that's my superpower and I lean into it.
That's a little bit of what I do. So yeah, we're a little closer than I think that Steven is to us then.
Yeah.
Not surprising.
I think you might be coming at it from more of like an intellectual curiosity perspective. And whereas like the curiosity that I have is like secondary, maybe driven by like the social part.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah, that is the thing that I do.
Well, yeah, it seems like, I mean, really, there's multiple tactics. So
the
key is to be invested in the outcome.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly that. Mm-hmm.
There was, I can't remember. I think I heard a speaker once. I went to like a Scrum Day event a couple years ago in the before times. Mm-hmm. And they had a speaker who was an author of a book called Turn This Ship Around. And I have the book. I've never read it. I do want to read it. It sounds interesting. And it was like the story of this submarine that, or maybe it was just a ship, not an underwater ship, but like a floating ship.
Yeah.
I can't remember. And it has the picture of the ship on the front of the book, but I haven't read the book, so I haven't looked at it. Okay. Anyway, so this ship of whatever sort was like not doing well. It was like very underperforming.
Yeah.
And, or it was really rough. And the captain, there was like the captain that was brought on board was supposed to captain a different vessel. Mm. And so he had prepared all of his knowledge for like a totally different ship.
Right. Oh.
And so he wasn't able to like come on board. It's and
like, I'm for like an underwater ship, not a floating ship.
I don't know if it was that drastic a difference, but for sure, like the way that the speaker described it was like this, you know, the captain like had all these, you know, specifications and parameters in his head that didn't apply to this ship. And so he had to rely on the crew to execute, to a specific level of degree that he maybe would not have had to rely on if he had been on the ship he was originally supposed to captain.
Yeah. Sure.
And so he started changing his tactics and went, instead of saying, I want you to do this, 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 he would say, okay, my intent is to achieve this outcome.
Yeah.
And then he would help, like the crew would help bring their expertise, their specific knowledge of that context on that boat to be able to execute that intention.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's something I try to do pretty often, is just like keep the intent in mind. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, if I feel like we're getting off, because you can kind of feel when a conversation gets like weird vibes. Yep. You feel like, mm-hmm, you aren't, like you're talking over each other.
Yeah.
It doesn't really feel like it's landing, or like you're not seeing like the spark of enthusiasm that comes with understanding.
Yep.
And if you spend too long within a conversation in that space, like you got to switch it up. And you can even just say, sometimes I just like narrate what I'm trying to do with the conversation. I can be like, hey, I don't feel like we're quite clicking, so I want to try something else. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, just like, it's okay to narrate what you want to do with the conversation, knowing that the conversation is a means to an end. Yeah, that's...
Well, that brings it really around to kind of what you started the topic with.
Yeah.
That idea of just being, like, trusting other people to do their work.
Right, right.
And you will sometimes be in a position where you have to provide a lot of trust.
Yes.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and salient code. A band name. It's not a band name. I'm assuming it's not a band.
No, it's a worse topic than that. I will say, just to interrupt your outro for a moment, we're on Mastodon now as well, so we'll put that in the show notes.
Yes.
And maybe we'll get that up on the website. Things are in flux now, as I think a lot of people know. Mm-hmm. We'll be wherever we all end up, I imagine.
We do like hearing from you on any platform. So if you're on Twitter, tweet back. And if you're on Mastodon, what do?
Toot.
Toot back. Or you can email us, contact@nicegames.club. Email is still a thing that hasn't been ruined.
Right, because it's a protocol.
Yeah. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we will be interviewing the Bugaboo Pocket Team for our last episode before hiatus. But that is it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Yeah, that's...
Well, that brings it really around to kind of what you started the topic with.
Yeah.
That idea of just being, like, trusting other people to do their work.
Right, right.
And you will sometimes be in a position where you have to provide a lot of trust.
Yes.
Like if you're on the wrong boat.
Exactly that.
It was the right boat. It wasn't the original boat.
What?
He didn't like wander up and he's like, oh gosh, I spent 2 weeks on this ship. I didn't realize it was the wrong one.
Okay, we should maybe practice example selling. Because there was this one and the elephant one.
My example are fine.
Okay.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.